following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas. It's my pleasure to introduce a program on James Lachlan, founder of New Direction Publishing House. Poet Susan Howe and I were fascinated by James Lachlan, who single-handedly, as a Harvard undergraduate, at the urging of Ezra Pound, started publishing modern literature in America. James Lachlan did for American publishing with New Directions what Leonard and Virginia Woolf did by starting the Hogarth Press in England. By a strange coincidence, of the three friends who became major American poets, the Hogarth Press first published T.S. Eliot, but New Directions became the publishers for Ezra Pound and H.D., the initials of Hilda Doolittle. And he continued to publish them all of their lives and his. He published all the great American poets. James Lachlan's love of poetry, no doubt, sprang from the fact that he was a poet as well as editor. And this conversation with Susan Howe and myself opens a whole chapter of early 20th century American literature. Afterwards, James Lachlan liked the interview so well that it was published in Bill Henderson's The Art of Literary Publishing in America. And James Lachlan received innumerable invitations to tell his stories at writers' conferences all over the country. Listen to James Lachlan. He opens a window on American literature.
This is Susan Howe. On this program, Charles Ruas and I will be interviewing James Lachlan, the poet and publisher of New Directions. The publishing business of New Directions was founded by James Lachlan while he was still an undergraduate at Harvard in 1936. During a leave of absence from Harvard, Lachlan had studied informally with Ezra Pound in Rapallo, and Pound had urged him to publish the works of a number of his friends and disciples in the United States, who were then without publishers. The first book, New Directions, 1936, beginning a series of annual anthologies, was produced by the printer of the college magazine, The Harvard Advocate. But later, as the business grew, larger printers were used. William Carlos Williams' novel White Mule was probably the first important book to be published by the firm. In the early days, Lachlan sold the books by mail or personally on the road, but later commission salesmen were used, and in 1961, sales and distribution were taken over by the J.B. Lippincott Company of Philadelphia, which has remained the exclusive distributor. Over the years, New Directions has published a remarkable list of titles, about 450 in number. The list has included American writers Juna Barnes, Tennessee Williams, Robert Duncan, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, John Hawkes, Thomas Merton, Henry Miller, Kay Boyle, Kenneth Patchen, Kenneth Rexroth, and Ezra Pound. And foreign authors such as Mishima, Lorca, Kafka, Hesse, Nabokov, Montale, Valerie, Rilke, and Rambo. You left Harvard in 1935, I read, to go to Europe. Why? And what long-term effect do you, if any, do you think that Harvard had on your taste and your thinking, what you chose to do?
Well, I left Harvard because I found it really extremely stuffy. There were, in those days, some very great men there, and I was fortunate to be able to work with some of the men like Ted Spencer and F.O. Matheson and some of the others. But in general, I would say that the academic ambience was not hospitable to the modern literature that I was already getting interested in at that age, because in my secondary school at Choate, I had had one of the great masters of all time, and great English teachers of all time. That was Dudley Fitts, the poet and the translator of Greek drama, who worked with Robert Fitzgerald on some of the early Greek versions of Greek plays. And when I came to Harvard, I had already been indoctrinated with a considerable passion for people like people such as Eliot and Pound and Yeats and Joyce and some others. And believe it or not, although this was, let's see, I would have gotten into Harvard, I think, in 33, there still were not courses being given in these writers. They were not yet accepted, although they were men of stature already on the international scene. And I remember in particular there was one course which was given then by the then professor of rhetoric, the holder of the Boylston chair. That, as you know, is the great honorary chair. Robert Fitzgerald has it now, Archie MacLeish has had it, and others have had it before them. And it has, by the way, the prerogative that the holder of the Boylston Chair of Rhetoric at Harvard may pasture a cow in the yard. I've always been trying to put Bob Fitzgerald up to the idea of renting a cow for the day and bringing it into Harvard to see if this would work or not. But the students walk on the grass so much that I think the cow would have a very bad day. Well, anyway, in those days, in 33 when I got there, the professor of rhetoric, whose name shall be now is passed into oblivion, would get so angry if the name of Eliot or Pound was mentioned in his course that he would ask the student to leave the room. And so that was somewhat the... that was a little bit the tenor of official established Harvard at that time, and I found it a little bit oppressive. So that when the opportunity came for me to get a leave of absence and to go abroad and to meet some people, I rapidly jumped at it and took off for Europe, and had the opportunity first of working with Gertrude Stein for several months.
How did that come about?
Well, that came about completely through happenstance. I had read her work, of course. I'd read her work at Choate and was very fascinated by the experiments which she was conducting with association and dissociation and all types of interesting experiment with language and her attempts to purify language by getting awake from conventional connotations, conventional styles, and so forth. I'd read her work, and I knew her work, but I'd never had any contact with her. But I happened to be in Salzburg during the summer after I was at the festival, the music festival in Salzburg, and in the quite entirely by serendipity, or whatever you want to call it, I met in the Schwimmbad, in the swimming pool, Professor Bernard Fay, the great... French scholar of American literature, who was an intimate friend, dear friend of Gertrude Stein's. And we got to talking in the swimming there and sunning in Salzburg. We got to talking about modern American literature. He'd spotted me as a young American student, so he wanted to pump me about what was going on with the young and American. We got talking about Gertrude, and I expressed admiration. He said, "Why, she's one of my best friends. Would you like to meet her?" And so here he wrote to her and arranged for me to go and stay with her at her farm in, it was down near the Lac d'Ancy in the foothills of the French Alps, a little place named, her house was in a little village named Belley near Bilignan. And, the house was called Bilignan and the town was Belley. I always get them mixed up. And she invited me to come and stay there. But there was a little catch in it, I found, when I got there. In fact, it was one of the most delightful months I've ever spent, because Gertrude was one of the most extraordinarily charismatic and magnetic and fascinating women that I have ever known, though she did have a few, shall we say, eccentricities. And Alice B. Toklas was equally fascinating in her totally totally different way, but they complemented each other perfectly, because Gertrude was the dominating, strong, powerful intellectual force, while Alice was sort of the tidier up after her, and the housekeeper, and the marvelous cook, and the one who kept things rolling, and the one who, she was, what do you call it in old vaudeville? She was the end man for Alice. She saw that the guests kept arriving, and the proper questions were asked at the proper time. Well, the catches to this visit with Gertrude were that she had some work that she wanted done. She was just about to set out. She'd been invited to, after many years of hoping for it, she'd been invited to come to this country and to give lectures at various universities. And she had written these six lectures, which are now available in a volume published, I think, by the University of Chicago Press, or they were published by the University of Chicago Press. But she needed press releases, or she thought she needed press releases. Somebody in the Paris press corps told her, nobody will understand what you're talking about when you give these lectures. You've got to have press digests of them. You've got to have it reduced to one page for each lecture. You've got to have a digest of these lectures which you will give out to reporters when you meet them. And so she put me to writing these boiled down versions of these lectures, and it was one of the most difficult things I've ever attempted in my life, because the lectures were highly epistemological and highly metaphysical, and written entirely in that extraordinary Steinese dialect of the disembodied word and the floating phrase. And to attempt to boil down the essential ideas out of a half-hour lecture to one page was something of a task, in which I would repeatedly fail, and I would bring her these pages, and she would read them and shake her head and say, "No, no, this is wrong. You've missed this. You've missed that. Go back and do it again." But I spent a really wonderful wonderful month there in this beautiful, beautiful countryside with Alice and Gertrude in this lovely little, it was called a chateau ferme. It was a stone house which was sort of bigger than a normal farmhouse but smaller than a chateau. But it had a marvelous terrace out on the front of it, a beautiful garden terrace, with a lovely view looking out over hills and valleys and poplar trees and fields. And I remember that Gertrude always used to sit on the wall with her back to the view, because she said that the only way you could properly take in a view was by sitting with your back to it. That was the way she was. She had these really quite extraordinary points of view about things.
After spending a month with her, what was your evaluation of her work and Gertrude Stein as a person?
Well, as I say, she was certainly one of the most fascinating women I've ever known. She simply riveted your attention whenever she was talking. The work itself, I think, divides into so many different categories that you kind of have to pick and choose what is best. Now, a lot of it was, in my opinion, definitely what we would call automatic writing. And I say that because I used to watch her do it. She would sit out on this terrace in a deck chair with a pad, and the hand would simply move ceaselessly without pause. In other words, the words, the ideas, were coming from somewhere deep down inside. And she never rewrote. As far as I know, she never rewrote anything. Alice would type out pieces that were going to be sent to magazines or sent to somewhere. She would type these out from Gertrude's hand notation. But when you looked at these pages that came from this work, they were almost indecipherable, showing to what extent they were coming from, in my opinion, the unconscious mind. Now, Alice had developed a great proficiency in reading this. It was really a scrawl. I mean, you can see the notebooks there at Yale there in the collection.
Yes.
But It was, I think, automatic writing, which is really nothing against it, except that, I mean, after all, lots of people have done automatic writing. Kerouac did a lot of automatic writing.
But also at that time, the whole surrealist school was...
Yes, they were all very deep into that kind of thing.
Yes.
Though she had no... Gertrude was very independent.
Hmm.
She was not at all tied up with the Dadaists or with the surrealists. She felt very much on her own. And while she was willing to be printed in magazines which printed them, she always felt completely apart from them and rather resentful if anyone attempted to identify her with them. And I think for that reason she may have been a little bit annoyed with Edmund Wilson, because in Axel's Castle he put her in the same book where he was dealing with other figures in French literature, and she really didn't like that too much.
That's the question I wanted to ask you next. How did it feel to grow up in a country where the best literature was in Europe, the best American literature, or the most exciting people were residing abroad?
Well, it seemed a very good reason to go to Europe.
Well, you spoke of the sterility of Harvard for you.
Yes.
So that there must have been a strange gap.
At that point, there was almost nothing. It's hard for a young kid now who is growing up in a country which has something like 300 or 400 little magazines, and which has all these schools for writers, and writers' seminars, and writers' groups, and poetry readings. It's a totally different climate. When I was 18 in Harvard, there was none of this. Poetry readings were practically unheard of. There was one poetry reading a year given at Harvard under the Morris Gray Fund. One a year, and then they would usually have, you know, some old venerable fellow who had thoroughly proven himself respectable, who was chosen by the older members of the faculty. And there were no little magazines. You see, you've got to remember that this was just after the Depression, and there was no money around, and everybody was broke. And the publishers, people like Liveright, a bit earlier, and people like the Boni brothers, who had been engaged in bringing out avant-garde literature, they had more or less gone broke and dropped out of business, so there was nothing left. The Dial had stopped publication. The Little Review, Margaret Anderson's Little Review, had stopped publication. Bill Williams's and John's Pagany had stopped publication. There were almost no little magazine. The only little magazine that was going on at that time when I was in college was Lincoln Kirstein's Hound and Horn, which was not a hunting magazine, as you know, but was one of the great literary and artistic magazines of that time. And Lincoln had founded that shortly after he finished to Harvard. And that was really the only thing that was coming out in this country.
Nowadays, in the 70s, the major publishing companies are not publishing poetry. There's many, many small presses now and small magazines. But do you see, at least from poets, I get the idea that over the past few years, it's almost impossible to get a book of poems published by a large publishing
commercial
house.
Firm.
I don't think that's quite... I wouldn't say that that is quite fair. If you look over the lists of the large publishers, you will find that there are at least half a dozen of the very best ones who make a regular practice of bringing out 3 or 4 volumes of good quality poetry each year. And then you have some presses, such as I think particularly of the Wesleyan University Press or the University of Pittsburgh Press, or a number of others which do even more than that. So that I don't think it's fair to say. It is true that now there are now in this country hundreds of small presses, thanks to two machines. The IBM Composer, this host is not a plug for IBM, but it's a wonderful machine on which a poet can sit down and can turn out himself a page of poetry which looks like printed type. And then the other thing, of course, is the offset press, where you don't have to go through linotype procedure or through plate-making procedure. You can simply lay out your pages, and almost anybody can run a small offset press, and then all you need is a cutter and a staple binder, and you can have a little magazine.
Yes.
And these things crop up every week. I get an announcement of a new little magazine from some group of poets. And these are very fine things because they encourage the young and they get stuff around. And while their circulations are extremely small, they are very influential.
How did you get into the decision that you would start a publishing?
Well, that was entirely due to the influence, the order, the directive of Ezra Pound.
Mm-hmm.
After I had spent the summer with Gertrude, and finally, after great labor, had turned out a few pieces of scraps of paper which she thought possibly might be acceptable as press releases, and then she left the country and went back up to Paris, and I went up to Paris too, and I had a room which I rented, I think, for 7 francs a month, which was near the Eiffel Tower. And I was rather poverty-stricken in those days because my parents didn't exactly approve of my not coming back to Harvard, and so they stopped sending me any money. And the only reason that I was able to stay in Europe was that I had a cousin of my mother's who was very sympathetic to my rebellion from my native city of Pittsburgh, and she would surreptitiously send me a check for $100 about every second month, and that's what I lived off of. But anyway, it was fine in Paris, and I was there, and I could go anytime I wanted to see Gertrude and get a free meal off of her, or serve off Bernard Faye or various of her friends or other writers that I met. But when the weather got cold, there was no heat in this little room that I had in Paris, which was actually, it was not in a boarding house or anything. It was a kind of a little closet room in an insurance office of a kind of fly-by-night insurance company on the second floor of a building near the Champ de Mars, near the Eiffel Tower. Well, when there was no longer any heat, and I didn't have any heavy sweaters or anything, all I had was a loden cape that I'd brought from Austria, life in Paris became a little bit difficult. So my Dudley Fitz, my master at Choate, he had corresponded with Pound considerably, and he knew Pound well by correspondence. So taking advantage of the Fitz connection, I wrote down to Pound and asked if I could come down and see him. And I received, to my amazement, a telegram in reply. And the telegram said, "Visibility high." So I took off by the next third-class night train and went down to Rapallo and found that here was this marvelous, again, eccentric, but marvelously hospitable man, a born teacher, a person who just loved young people and loved to talk to young people and to carry on these marvelous pedagogical monologues. He was a teacher manqué, if ever there was one. I found that it was possible to enroll without any tuition fees whatever in what was known as the Ezuversity. Now this meant that you could have lunch with Ezra. You paid for your own lunch, but things were very inexpensive then in Italy, and you could spend the afternoon with Ezra, either taking walks or playing tennis with him, or going rowing with him when it came to be summer, or playing doing various things with him, and then you could have tea with Ezra and Mrs. Pound, and then you could even have dinner, and if you could stand it, after dinner you could go to the ghastly Italian movies. This was the days before art had arrived in the Italian film industry, after dinner. And all the while that this was going on, there was this continual monologue of wonderful information on every conceivable subject coming out of Ezra, and this is what constituted the Ezuversity.
What was he working on at that time?
He was working on chiefly, by that period, you see, this would have been about 19, by this time it would have been 1935. Chiefly by then, he was immersed in his history, his revaluations of history, his studies, particularly of the early American founding fathers, the Adams Cantos, the Jefferson stuff. And he was working principally in his economic theories, his theories of social credit, which he had picked up from Orage and from Douglas in England. So he was working, he was doing particular research on the connections between banks and armament manufacturers and things of that kind.
Was he also at that time developing his theory of history?
Yes, this was the period when his rather unusual interpretation of history was being hammered out from his readings, and all sorts of people from all over the world with whom he was corresponding, and he had an enormous correspondence, would send him books, and he would read up this stuff, and then he would put the pieces together, and then he had a kind of a network all over the world of young people to whom he would write, who would find books for him, and who were supposed to start inserting pieces of propaganda about his theories in magazines. But it was a marvelous course, because people kept dropping in through Rapallo. It's on the main train line between Genoa and Rome, and all kinds of writers would keep stopping off and would stop off for a few days and would sort of join in on the discussion. And while I think I was, at the time that I was there, I was the principal student in the university of the Esuversity, I should say. Other people were always coming in, Bunding and Zhukovsky and any number of different writers would keep passing through, so that you kept meeting all sorts of interesting people and learning all sorts of interesting things. And then Ezra would give you books to read, and then you
What were his working habits? It would sound, from what you said, it sounded like he was talking and mixing all day.
Well, he got up fairly early, and he worked during the mornings. And it was during the mornings that he did the main amount of work that he did, and then of course he read late at night. And his office was a marvelous place. It was they had the top flat on the floor, the top floor, the penthouse floor of an apartment on the seafront there in Rapallo, and it was a very narrow structure, and it was a series of little rooms in a line, and one of these rooms was his office. And in order to keep things disentangled in his office, he had many of his things hanging by strings from the ceiling. Thus, his pencil and his pen and his scissors and in his eraser and his extra spectacles and all these things were hanging by strings from the roof above his typewriter. And then he had his files. His files were hung up either by strings or on hooks on the wall so that he could reach back from his chair and get at them. Mm-hmm. And he did his work in the morning, and a great part of it is he used to say that his biggest living expense was postage, because he carried on this enormous correspondence with people all over the world, answering their letters and exhorting them to get to the bottom of the roots of the money evil, and how the bank systems were abusing credit, and how history was being distorted for the benefit of the bankers and the armament makers.
Okay. Was his daughter born at that time?
Let's see. Mary would have... Yes, Mary, I forget just when she was born. She's a bit younger than I am. But she was living at that time up in northeastern Italy in the mountains. She was living there with the Marker family, the peasants who were sort of her adoptive family. Because Ezra never wanted children around. He didn't want the noise and fuss of children. But anyway, Ezra, I worked there with Ezra, and I would write little things, and show them to him, and he would break the points off his pencils of stabbing out the extra words. I'd write a poem or a little story or something. He said, "You don't need that word. Take that out. Cross, crash, bang," and all the half of what I had written had come out, and so that these manuscripts that I'd present to him looked like battlefields. And finally, in the end, he said to me, "Jas," he said, "it's no use." I said, "What do you mean, boss?" He said, "It's no use. You are not going to make a writer. You're too verbose. You've had too much Harvard. You are not going to make a writer, so why don't you do something useful?" Well, I said, "What do you mean by useful?" He said, "Go back to America and start printing things. None of my friends have any publishers. All their publishers have gone broke with the Depression. There needs to be a publisher to print them." So, working on his directive, I returned to America. I re-enlisted at Harvard. They took me back. It was no hard feeling. And I started beginning to bring out books. The first ones were actually printed by the same fellow up in Vermont who printed the Harvard Advocate. And then later I found three or four printers in Harvard Square who would bring out books for me. And I did the distribution by simply climbing into my car during reading periods and during vacations and driving around the country trying to peddle them to stores and libraries, where I was regarded as a very curious beast, because this tall young man would come in this strange outfit. I was still wearing my Austrian cape, and sell them these odd authors such as Kay Boyle and William Carlos Williams and Robert McCowman and Ezra Pound and people whom they didn't, most of these storekeepers didn't know what in God's name this stuff was, but usually out of pity for this eccentric young man, they would buy two or three copies, and that's how the business got started.
Did Ezra Pound turn you to William Carlos Williams?
Yes.
That's
how I got to know Williams, yeah. Because you see, Williams had had... Williams's publishing history was very difficult. He had had to, I think he'd had to pay for his own one of the early books. I think it's called the Alcaiquieri, which was Ezra arranged for that to be done by Elkin Matthews, one of his early publishers in London. I think Bill had to pay for that, and then his other early experimental books, the prose books such as Corin Hell. And the great American novel, and then the Spring and All. That's
yeah.
The fourth one. All those, you see, were done in Paris, published mostly by Ezra's friends, such as Bob McCowman, who was running the Contact Press, or by Bill Bird, who worked as a night editor at the Paris Tribune, and who had the Three Mountains Press on the side. So that almost all of Bill's early books were published in Paris and were hardly distributed in this country at all, and were known only really to a kind of a small and select group of his friends, who passed them around more or less hand to hand. And then one of them also was published by George Oppen, the poet,
yeah.
who was living in France, then down in the south of France, and who had something called Two Press. And then that led into the Objectivist Press, and that's how the Objectivist school got started. People like Zhukovsky, Reznikov, who just died, unfortunately, Rakosi, George Oppen, and several others, and then Ezra published with them the Objectivist Anthology. But Bill had, so that almost all of Bill's early books were published, you might almost say, semi-privately. And there had been only one book published, I think, as far as I know. No, there had been two books published by established publishers in this country. There was the American Grain, which was published by Boney and Liveride, and then there was the early novel A Voyage to Pagany, which was published by a firm named Macaulay, which very promptly went broke. So that the time I came along, and Bill had all these poems accumulated, and he also had... He also had the first parts of the Stecker trilogy, the White Mule, ready. He had no publisher. And so Ezra immediately sent me to Bill and said, here's this young guy who's willing to print your books for you. And Bill said, well, what do you know about publishing? And I said, nothing. And he said, well, that's all right. I don't know anything about it either. So he let me have his next books. And they, of course, greatly helped to strengthen the list and get it going, because they did begin to have some limited acceptance, though it wasn't really until the 60s that William Carlos Williams became properly famous.
Recognized. Mm-hmm. Were you influenced by private presses such as Sylvia Beach in Paris and Hogarth in London?
I didn't know much about the Hogarth Press. I didn't get to London much in those days, so that I didn't have much contact with the Hogarth thing. But I did, of course, know. I was particularly influenced, really, by McCowman's Contact Press books, and I did also know, of course, I knew the books that Sylvia Beach had done. No, actually, Sylvia didn't do a great many books. You know, she mm-hmm. did the Ulysses, and what else did she do? I don't think she did publish a great many books. Sylvia's place was more an institution. It was a place. Mm-hmm. She was the Frances Steloff of Paris, mm-hmm. and the Shakespeare and Company in the Rue de l'Odéon was the Gotham Book Mart of yeah. Paris. It was the place, you know, where Hemingway could get his mail, and everybody else would drop in to see Hemingway.
What about Harry Crosby? Did you, the Black Sun Press, did you know them at all?
I didn't get to meet them until considerably later. I did not know Harry Crosby before his death, yeah. but I got to know Caress later, and she was a very extraordinary and remarkably dynamic woman.
But they put out beautiful books.
Oh, they were lovely.
Beautiful.
Of course, there in that case, there was plenty of money. Because she came of a pretty well-off family, and so did he. They both came of well-off mm-hmm. family, so they were able to print their books extremely handsomely. But they did books of Pound, and they did some D.H. Lawrence, and they did any number of interesting people.
Mm-hmm. I'd be very curious to know what happened, for example, to your list, which included Pound, during the 40s, during the Second World War, and the position it must have forced you into, especially in the trial and when Pound was at St. Elizabeth.
Well, you've got several questions there. First
exactly.
of all, the list began to grow in various sideways ways, because I didn't simply limit myself to publishing the Ezra's friends and those whom he recommended. I also came strongly under the influence of various other people, mm-hmm. and some of them quite different schools of thought than Ezra. I was very much influenced, for example, by Ivor Winters, the critic and poet and professor at Stanford. And I did a number of books which he suggested, including a couple of his own and a couple of anthologies that he put together. And we did also two of his early books of essays. Then I very soon thereafter met Kenneth Rexroth. And Rexroth became a strong influence in directing me toward various authors whom I should publish.
Was he on the coast?
Yes, he was. Rexroth was already established in San Francisco by then. Mm-hmm. And then I began a process of doing modern classics, translations particularly, which were not available. That is, things like Rimbaud and Baudelaire and Lorca and all sorts of modern classic sort of things, which were needed as the forerunners of the modern movement. And we did a little surrealist anthology also in one of our annuals.
And I can also remember that you were one of the few presses that had James's middle novels.
Yes, we were involved, thanks to F.O. Matheson, with whom I became friends after I returned to Harvard. We were very much involved in the James revival. We did Matheson's collection of James's stories of artists and writers. We did a new edition of The Spoils of Poynton, which was out of print then. And we also helped to revive a number of other people. For example, believe it or not, at that period, F. Scott Fitzgerald was totally out of print.
That's pretty shocking.
It's hard to believe, but yeah. after his initial success, there'd been a kind of an eclipse, you know, after he had his troubles and got out to Hollywood and was having such a hard time. And he was totally out of print. And the way Fitzgerald came my way was that Edmund Wilson was his literary executor. And Wilson had been showing The Crack Up, which was the collection of Fitzgerald's miscellaneous papers that he wrote during the periods of the later part of his life and his illness. He'd been showing that around. Every big publisher in New York had turned it down. And so he brought it to me, and I jumped at it, of course. And then I found out, after we'd done The Crack Up, and The Crack Up went, I think, through five printings, that was the start of the Fitzgerald revival. Then we found, we talked to Scribners and found that they had no Fitzgerald in print. They had been hit hard by the Depression, I guess, or something, or they just thought there was no interest in Fitzgerald. So for a while we leased The Great Gatsby from them, and we had Lionel Trilling do an introduction for it. But, of course, we lost it later when the boom really got going, and then Scribner saw, well, it was very profitable to put all of Fitzgerald back into print. But then there was a similar situation with E.M. Forster. Owing to a tiff which Forster had had with dear old Alfred Knopf, a man whom I enormously respect, but who can be a little, shall we say, acerb, something to do with an invitation to lunch in London. Knopf had allowed the Forster books to go out of print, so that we leased two of those from him. We had The Longest Journey, and I think we had Where Angels Fear to Tread for many years. And I would say that we were instrumental, because we then got Trilling also to write a book about Forster, which was the start of the Forster revival, and put him back into popularity.
During this whole period, was publishing determined by academic criterion?
I wouldn't say so, no. No, I don't think so.
Because it's hard for me at this point to understand how certain writers could have been eclipsed so totally. And yet in the revival,
I think I can explain that. I think that the general reading public, you see, had forgotten about these people because they weren't bringing out new books. And the tendency to teach modern literature in the colleges had not yet gotten started. So there was a kind of a hiatus. You had people like Matheson and Spencer at Harvard and others like Robert Penwarren and Tate and people like that in other places who wanted to teach modern writing. But it took them quite a while, and Ransom particularly, I should speak of John Crow Ransom, the author of The New Criticism and the great poet. These people wanted to teach modern literature, but it took them a long time to get it into the curriculum because it was so very bitterly resisted by the old guard of the English departments. And you have actually a situation still in England, I'm told, where it's considered that the teaching of contemporary literature is ridiculous, that contemporary literature is something which people read for their diversion, and what you should be studying is the classics. Whereas nowadays it's completely reversed. If you go into almost any English department in the colleges now here in this country, you will find that the popular courses are the courses in the modern novel or in the modern poetry, and that they really have to struggle to get people to read Milton and Pope.
Yes.
Then you spoke about the war. The war was very hard on us because of the paper rationing. Because just at this point of the Second World War, we were really beginning to get going. The books were getting a little better known, and I'd set up some better distribution arrangements, and I had a marvelous guy named George Stewart, who was a salesman who went around the country and helped sales things. And just at this time, as we began to get going, the books began to get known, we began to get reviews and to get them around, then suddenly the government, because of the war, imposed this paper rationing, that you could only have so much paper as you had used in something like the year 1930, I think the year 1937 or something. Well, that was a year when we'd done almost nothing. So there we were sitting, unable to buy paper legally, and I didn't want to do it illegally, and we had all these more and more good manuscripts coming in and no way to get them printed. And that was very, very difficult, and it meant, for example, that we had to hold back on a lot of things. We had to hold back reprints. We had to delay a long time on, certain of William Carlos Williams' books of that period had to be done by other presses simply because we couldn't stir up the paper to do them.
Can we go back to Pound first?
Yeah, certainly.
And the war? How did that affect you?
Well, we were totally cut off. We didn't know what had happened to Ezra because there was no mail coming through. Ezra had come over. He had come over just before the war. He'd made his last trip to this country in what was a futile effort to try to persuade the American government that a war was coming and they should stay out of it if they could. But he had had absolutely no success in, he had hoped through his friendship with Congressman Tinkham of Boston, the man who is famous for having ridden his horse into saloons in Roxbury in order to get votes, whom Ezra, Tinkham was a wealthy eccentric of the Boston aristocracy, whom Ezra had met on the beach at the Lido in Venice. And Ezra had hoped that through Tinkham all doors would be opened to him, and that he would be able to meet Roosevelt and the other politicians, you know, and the people, and that he could explain to them that the wicked bankers were stirring mm-hmm. up another war, and America must at all costs stay out.
Mm-hmm.
But people in Washington just wouldn't pay any attention to him, so that trip was a terrible letdown for Ezra and was really very abortive for him. And then, after the war started, complete blackout. Mm-hmm. We couldn't, the Pounds, Mr. and Mrs. Pound stayed on in Italy. Ezra wanted, I think, to come back, but he couldn't get a passport for his daughter because of technical irregularities and a nasty American consul somewhere who didn't want to cooperate or didn't like him. So there they were, stuck in Italy and almost starving, and we couldn't get any word from them. We just couldn't get any word out. So there was we were much concerned, and there was a total blackout in communications there. For the first thing I think I finally heard was when they when we read in the papers that Ezra was being brought to Washington for trial for having made those broadcasts that he made in all good faith, I may say. He was still trying to get America out of the war. He said, this didn't fit in with his concepts of history that we should be fighting this war.
I'm interested in the political aspect of your career at this point. You'd always known Ezra Pound as an avant-garde poet who to some extent stayed let's say on the outside, and suddenly you saw him tried politically as a traitor or accused of being a traitor. And I'm wondering what shift in attitude you may have had at that point and how you understood the situation.
Well, I understood it simply Ezra was in except for the anti-Semitism, which I never could abide or tolerate, and that was one thing that Ezra and I used to fight about because I just couldn't stomach that. And I think it was definitely a part of his mental condition. I think it was the psychiatrist who treated him after he was brought to Washington told me very definitely that the anti-Semitism was a recognized symptom of the kind of paranoid mental state which he had developed as a result of not being listened to by anybody in power who could put any of his ideas into practice. But I think apart from the anti-Semitic stuff, which I find repulsive and which I'm happy to say he repudiated in his old age, I always agreed with his economic theories. I mean, I'm a social creditor to this day. I still think that the economic system which we have of a pyramid of debt finance is absolutely ridiculous and is going to bring us to a complete crash and dissolution of our system if it is not corrected within a reasonable time. I mean, we see, I don't want to get into politics, but we see that in the condition of the city of New York with its vast debt on which it cannot pay the interest. And Ezra was always saying, you see, for years, that money was credit, that money was social credit, that it must be used as a ticket, and that it must not be something on which somebody else charged rent, a banker or a government charged rent in order that creative production might take place. So that I was a social creditor and I was totally sympathetic to his economic ideas all along.
But did you think he should have been hospitalized for those views, if you were so in sympathy with him?
Well, the situation, you've got to look back to the hysterical climate of those days. There would have been a very good chance that, given the fact that he technically had made these broadcasts, even though he prefaced each one by saying that he was doing his duty as an American citizen in making these broadcasts, that he was upholding the Constitution and trying to warn people against Roosevelt's mistakes and warn people against the tie-ups between the American government and the international bankers, you've got to look at the climate and realize that there was a very good chance that he would have either been hung, because there was no precedent of what you did with people who made broadcasts which could be considered by people to be traitors, or that he would have received a long term. Now, another fellow who did the same thing, Douglas Chandler, who broadcast from Germany, he got something like 30 years, which he worked off by good behavior, but he was down here in Danbury, and then he was in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, for about 20 years. And this could very well have happened to Ezra. So that I think the feeling of all of us, our friends, was that it would be, although we believed in what he had done and were convinced of his honesty and integrity, that it might have been very difficult to convince a jury of this fact. and that it was probably therefore desirable to go along with the ruling of the government psychiatrist that he was too confused in mind to stand trial.
But it was a shattering experience for him.
Oh, yes, it was terribly shattering for him because, you know, they had him, when they had him in the DTC, the camp for bad soldiers in Italy, they had him, for a while there, they had him locked up in a cage made out of airplane strip landing mats, and he really had a complete nervous breakdown at that time, and really, he really went, he had a nervous breakdown, put it that way. He lost control, and he gradually recovered. But when he arrived in this country, he was not able to understand why they were trying him. For an example, when I heard that he was coming, I asked my lawyer, Julian Cornell, who's a wonderful chap, he's a Quaker, to go down and meet him and attempt to see what could be done to look after him and to defend him. And Julian did go down and meet him and talked to him at great length and came back and reported to me, and he said, I cannot make Ezra understand what his situation is. He cannot grasp that he has done anything that was treasonable. He did not mean to be treasonable. He considers himself an American. He considers himself a better American than most of the people who are running the country. He cannot see why he should be tried for anything. In fact, Sir Julian, he thought that when they brought him back, what they were doing really was bringing him to this country because of his great knowledge of Confucius, to brief him at the State Department and then send him over to Japan to be a special aide to General MacArthur to help for the rebuilding of Japan along Confucian lines.
Goodness.
Which gives you an indication of how, shall we say, removed from common reality he had become.
The last 10 years of his life, he's supposed to have been silent. Did you see him during that time?
Yes, and it was true. He spoke hardly at all.
What do you think it was? Do you think it was remorse, old age, rage, or what? Why do you think?
I think it was a withdrawal brought about by acute disappointment that the world didn't listen to his ideas about economics and history, and a feeling that disappointment and also in the philosophical sense, although Ezra was never a mystic, he poo-pooed mysticism. It was a withdrawal into his own spiritual domain and a rejection of the world which had rejected him.
Was he aware of the growing influence of his work at that time? In the last 10 years of his life,
well, he must have been aware of it because, you know, so many books were being written about him and so many articles, and we'd always send these books to him, or people would see him, and students were constantly trying to stop by to see him in Venice or Rapallo to talk to him, and so he certainly was aware that he'd become famous. At the same time, it was really tragic that he couldn't accept with very much happiness the admiration for his poetry, because what was more basic to him, what seemed to him more important, were his economic ideas and his political ideas and his historical ideas. And he couldn't separate the two, and he couldn't take happiness in the fact, you know, that people thought that the Chinese translations or the Moberly or bits and pieces of the beauty spots of the cantos were terribly tremendous and great. He couldn't take much pleasure in that when they wouldn't pay attention to the to his economic ideas. He really couldn't. He felt almost that he'd failed in what was to him his main mission.
Mm-hmm. They made records of his readings from the cantos at that period.
Yes,
and I was
wondering,
did he continue writing?
Oh yes, he was writing all the time. All the time that he was in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, he was writing. He was translating Chinese.
Yeah.
He was doing the Greek translations of the Women of Trachis, and he also did a translation of Sophocles' Electra, which we are trying to find. The typescript of it apparently is lost somewhere, but we hope to find it in a collection of stuff that was rescued from his wife's Washington apartment. And he was working on the last cantos, on Thrones, which is the last section of the cantos. He was enormously industrious while he was in St. Elizabeth Hospital in Washington. It was simply incredible the way he kept on working. He simply did not let his spirits flag at all. He thought of himself as a political prisoner. He thought of other great political prisoners throughout the history of the world who had, you know, Nehru in prison wrote the history of the world, and he kept right on with his work the whole time and turned out marvelous stuff.
I'm wondering if your relationship with Pound affected New Direction during the McCarthy era. Did you come under suspicion?
I suppose I did, but I never heard about it. I don't know.
Were you concerned about the writers who were brought up before McCarthy's committee?
Well, they weren't. I don't think any of our immediate group were particularly bothered by him. The only one who had trouble was William Carlos Williams, and that came out later, as you know, when he had the appointment to be Librarian of Congress, and that was taken away from him on some very flimsy and undefinable grounds of some political connection. But I think my reaction to the McCarthy era was simply the one that everybody else had, that this was a perfectly dreadful man, and couldn't somebody please get rid of him somehow? But I had no intimate contact with him through writers.
You have been listening to poet and publisher of New Directions, James Laughlin, being interviewed by Susan Howe and Charles Ruas. This program was produced by Susan Howe for WBAI in New York City.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.